Iran says the International Atomic Energy Agency should not be affected by political objectives some countries are pursuing. A car plows into a crowd during a Christmas parade in the U.S. city of Waukesha, leaving at least 5 people dead and dozens more wounded. Unrest hits the Netherlands for the 3rd consecutive night amid public anger at the government's coronavirus restrictions. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Now, top story this hour, Iran dismissing the latest U.S. threats against the country. And this after Washington said that of all options on table, the upcoming talks of the parties to the 2015 nuclear deal fail. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says that the U.S. has previously carried out as threats in the countries like Afghanistan, and the results are there for everyone to see. Said Khatibzadeh added that Iran's focus on the Vienna talks is the removal of what are called unilateral and tyrannical sanctions. He expressed hope that the upcoming visits by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency chief to Iran is constructive as before. The spokesman said that Iran has always called on the agency to pursue technical cooperation and prevent abuse of its name by other countries for their own political agendas. And from London, I'm joined by Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Good to have you with us, Mr. Abbas. So let us, let our viewers actually have a better picture of the question why Iran should be so sensitive regarding the upcoming Vienna talks starting on November 29th. I want you to tell our viewers about this. What good reasons does Iran have to be asking for guarantees and things like that?
Well, first of all, the fact that the United States in the first place walked out unilaterally without any notice, that in itself is a big green light. What guarantees do the Iranian establishment have from the rest of the world or the other parties involved, or even the US, that the same thing won't happen again as soon as, say, for instance, Joe Biden leaves office, or even during Joe Biden's tenure? What guarantee does the Islamic Republic of Iran have that Israel isn't dictating the American policy in that region? And therefore, if it's Israel that Iran should be negotiating with around nuclear arms, then what's the point of the rest of these nations? And talking of Israel, JCPOA omits, for me, a few very, very important things for the security of Iran. And Iran's already made, I think, huge concessions by even considering the JCPOA agreements, given that, first of all, Israel is the only warhead equipped nation in West Asia, creating a huge imbalance in geostrategic conditions, and it's sanctioned by the Americans and supported by them. It's not the program, the Israeli nuclear program, is not subject to anybody's scrutiny. They're not subject to the NPO. The whole nuclear proliferation agreement isn't binding on them. They don't necessarily know what they're doing. And yet here we have the hypocrisy of an America that supports a nuclear arms equipped Israel, upholding supposedly Iran to account. So that's the first point, why there really can't be a great deal of trust. The Americans have a track record of reneging on treaties. The Paris Agreement, you'll recall the Trans-Pacific Agreement, which was supposed to bring economic peace and harmony with China and the world. That fell through. So I could go through a whole litany of agreements that they've just torn up at a whim. So again, they have track record. The other aspect is the other main belligerent in West Asia, Saudi Arabia, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, is being openly supported by the Americans and the West generally in developing nuclear power. Not only supporting it, they're actively encouraging their corporate companies and state apparatus to tender for contracts for nuclear development of Saudi Arabia. How on earth are you going to ask Iran to move away from any kind of nuclear peaceful activity and at the same time tell its key protagonists, the key problem creators within West Asia, that they have carte blanche to absolutely continue. So, you know, just those, you know, would America unilaterally disarm without Russia or China or anybody else doing it? So if the Americans wouldn't do that themselves, the West wouldn't do that themselves, why are they expecting Iran to take part in no kind of nuclear development? And even there, Ayatollah Khamenei said that we, on a matter of religious principle and moral principle, do not want to develop nuclear weapons. We're purely after nuclear energy for our own use, peaceful use. So those are just some of the obvious pointers for me, which say, no, there's a big problem. The EU itself can't point to America. They promised the INSTEX system, which was supposed to kick in to help Iran reduce the problem of American blanket sanctions, the worst sanctions ever imposed on a nation ever. And they lied. Essentially, the EU hasn't triggered the INSTEX system, didn't do anything about it. So you can see that there's a deviousness, there's a underhand alternative kind of dealing with Iran, which is based on their prejudices on so many levels of you know, Iranians, or Iranophobia, Islamophobia, you know, the need to be imperialists and go in and belligerently dominate a region. They want Iran to give up its defense system as well. How long will it take the Americans to listen to the Israelis again, even if they would sign this agreement, to then move on and say to Iran, oh, well, actually, you know, we don't like what you're doing in the region, with the fact that you've even got a geostrategic involvement in the Middle East, which is your neighborhood, is a problem for us. How long will it take for Israel to re-raise those issues? I think far more emphasis by the Americans and the West should be paid on Israel, the local attack dog, which they use to create disharmony. Iran has never attacked a nation. Not in 200 years plus has Iran invaded any of its neighbors. Yet the West, even though it wants to talk about JCPOA and peace from this point of view, imposes economic terrorism, arms all those nations like Azerbaijan even now on the borders of Iran, disrupting Iraq, equipping ISIS, having bases lined up all around Iran, which have nuclear and other capacity, no doubt. On what basis is Iran supposed to really trust these guys?
Okay. Thank you very much. Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator in London. A car ramming incident during a holiday parade in the U.S. state of Wisconsin has left five people dead. That incident happened in the city of Waukesha, west of Milwaukee. Police saying over 40 people were also injured, but numbers could be revised. Many children were among the victims. A video posted on social media showed a red SUV speeding toward marchers taking part in the city's Christmas parade. It was sped off after mowing them down. Police saying that the vehicle involved has been recovered, and one person of interest is in custody as investigations go on.
An officer did discharge his weapon at the suspect vehicle to try to stop the vehicle. No bystanders were injured as a result of the weapon discharge. We're no longer looking for a suspect vehicle. We do have a person of interest in custody at the moment, but this is still a very fluid investigation.
While it's still not known what the potential motive was or if the incident was related to terrorism, however, a shelter-in-place order issued after the incident in the city has been lifted. Waukesha schools and roads will remain closed on Monday. An official says the White House is closely monitoring the situation there. We'll continue to bring you updates on this story. Now, protests against coronavirus restrictions continue across the Netherlands for the third consecutive night. According to police, 130 people have been arrested. A flashpoint was the city of Enschede, where an emergency order is in place. Protests saw police clash with angry people who set up fireworks and vandalized properties. Authorities saying the Sunday night's unrest was less violent than the ones in the past two nights. The night before, police resorted to water cannons to disperse the ralliers in The Hague. Several officers were injured there. Also on Friday, four people were killed by police live fire in Rotterdam. The demonstrations center around new COVID restrictions, including a potential mandatory vaccination for access to indoor venues. A public anger continues to simmer in the U.S. over the acquittal of a militia member who fatally shot two anti-racism protesters in August 2020. In a news review program we shot a while ago, we've discussed that issue with our guests.
is segment where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. Public anger continues to simmer in the United States over the acquittal of a militia member who fatally shot two anti-racism protesters in August 2020. Protesters marched in different cities across the country, condemning the court's verdict that the shootings by Kyle Rittenhouse were in self-defense. In the city of Kenosha, Wisconsin, people gathered for a rally organized by faith leaders and activists to protest the acquittal of Rittenhouse. In Chicago, demonstrators hit the streets chanting Black Lives Matter. They also carried signs reading White Supremacy Equals Terrorism. Protests also erupted in Tampa, Florida and Minneapolis, Minnesota. The Rittenhouse verdict has sparked fierce criticism of the country's justice system and its preferential, I should say, treatment of white supremacists. So joining us is Colin Campbell, our correspondent in Washington, D.C., and also Life Malcolm, criminal defense and civil rights attorney from Tampa. Gentlemen, welcome. Colin, if I start with you, I guess, how much damage has this verdict done? The reaction from activists, gun control groups, civil rights leaders, politicians have not been positive at all, with the exception of some right-wing Republicans.
Okay, so when you say damage, I'm assuming you mean to the cultural ethos of the country. And if you ask that, if it's really had an impact, I really will not make that much of an impact going forward. I know that sounds crazy to think, but we already have a system of white hegemony in place in the U.S. So when you think about that, when you think about why these protests happened in the first place, where Jacob Blake being shot in the back, it's not the first time we've heard about this. It's not the first time we've heard of a black man, whether he was unarmed or armed, being shot and either maimed by police or definitely shot and killed by police. This happens several times a year. We know that black men are disproportionately shot and killed by police more than their white counterparts. This has been, they were probably keeping records, this has happened. So at least in recent history, this has been the dynamic. So this is not going to be any different. And then when you have a white boy, now a white man, I guess, because he was 17 at the time, now he's 18, to be acquitted of all these charges, that's almost par for the course. When you think about Trayvon Martin and what happened there, where you had a white antagonist towards a black person, and then that black person is the person who ended up getting killed, but that person who was the original antagonist was acquitted. Now, even though in Kenosha it was white men who were killed, it's still the same type of dynamic because of the laws in this state of Wisconsin. And I think that's what a lot of people are angry about, because the optics are that you had this white boy who came in with a gun that is purposely designed to kill people, and he killed two people and maimed a third. And now he's going to be a free man like nothing ever happened, when you have people who are killed for much less of a crime.
Okay, so Life, the officer who shot Jacob Black, for example, let's take that case, seven times in the back, and I'm assuming seven times because he ran out of bullets, walked away, not even, you know, manslaughter charges, nothing. And he came from the same police department as the one that allowed Rittenhouse to march alongside the police, carrying a dangerous firearm at the time with angry protests were going on. It's the police system, it's the justice system. How do you fix this racism?
You know, you've heard me say over and over again, the struggle for colonized people in the U.S. and around the world is not a struggle against racism. You know, the victorious people, courageous and victorious people of the Taliban weren't struggling in Afghanistan for some, you know, against some kind of racism, against the oppressors not liking them. They struggled for power. They struggled for land. They struggled to be self-governing. And that's the real question here in the U.S. for colonized people. If people are upset with the Rittenhouse verdict, they shouldn't be upset with just this Rittenhouse verdict as if it's an isolated incident, as Colin so eloquently stated. This country, the United States, it's so, I don't call it a justice system. It's a criminal business system. It's a state apparatus of coercion. The only way that this colonial institution can maintain its the hegemony that Colin referenced is through the most brutal and violent terroristic acts that they perpetrate on colonized people all the So the laws that allowed Kyle Rittenhouse to be a free person today are laws of that colonial system. And if people are upset with that verdict, then they ought to be upset with the system that from which that those laws come. We have to be in a position to declare a power and control over our own lives, to say what is just and what is not just, just like the ruling class can currently do, and in such a way that allows Kyle Rittenhouse to walk away. All these people out who are protesting and holding signs and expressing these different kinds of ideas of discontent with the verdict, should not isolate their energy and efforts to the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict. I mean, this thing has been in place since Nat Turner was put on trial for fighting against the slave master, which everybody now agrees slavery was a horrible institution, and the law put Nat Turner on trial and condemned him to death for fighting against that. So it's the same system. We got to be upset with the system.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. It's a serious issue and very serious points have been raised. Colin Campbell, our correspondent in Washington, D.C., and Life Malcolm, thank you very much indeed for your time and thoughts as well. Criminal defense and civil rights attorney joining us from Tampa. And that brings it end to another edition of the News Review.
Yemeni people have taken to the streets in different cities to condemn U.S. support of Saudi-led war on their country for years. Protesters slammed Washington for being the main contributor to the aggression against Yemen. The protesters in the city of Sada said that all U.S. administrations have sought to exploit Yemen in line with their own interests. The rallies warned that the siege of Yemen would bring Riyadh and allies nothing but greater loss. They pledged that the Yemenis would retaliate against any enmity. In nearly 7 years, Saudi-led war in Yemen has killed thousands of people. Washington and its allies are helping Riyadh in its warmongering, including by selling weapons.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
The subject of climate change has been discussed throughout the years and decades, so much so that you would think strides have been made. However, that is not the case. Major corporations and rich countries have fallen short in their so-called promises. Hi, I'm Kabit Halfway. In this edition of the program, we will take a look at COP26 summit in Glasgow. What happened there? Climate pledges made, did it fall short? Also, we're going to take a look at the following. The COP26 summit was something that was hailed, but the commitments by 25 nations to end finance for overseas oil and gas, well, it fell short. The catch would not take effect until the year 2022. Then, hypocrisy in action. COP26 deal lacks large coal-using countries. Study shows CO2 almost back at pre-COVID-19 level. The guilty countries that did not pledge: Australia, China, and the United States. Also, take a look at the climate protests. one of the highlights of the COP26 summit. Coal pledge, a complete joke, is what the youth act climate activists said, worried they were, and rightly so, the disconnect between slow pace of emissions reductions and climate emergency.
Nothing will be saved without you. It is important to begin with the fact. You were born to be creators of the ground entrusted.
The 26th session of the Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
The opening of the COP26 summit in Glasgow. But it all came down to the final draft communique.
So, you know, we got a very lengthy draft decisions from the presidency.
We need much more concrete action to be sure that we actually really meet this 1.5 target.
But the details of the draft showed the inconsistency with the intention of phasing out coal.
There is a reference of phasing out coal. And we are a stronger believers that phase out of coal deserves also a deadline.
Let's take a look at some social media posts on this issue. We go straight to the U.S. with this tweet. It's from Climate Reality, which is founded by the former U.S. Vice President Al Gore. More than 250,000 Americans are exposed to levels of cancer risk above the highest limits set by the EPA. It's an environmental justice nightmare, and the culprits won't surprise you. Toxic pollution from fossil fuels and petrochemical facilities. Now, we're going to stay in the U.S. and look at U.S. Senator Ted Cruz and what he said about the climate change summit that took place in Glasgow. This tweet from the Post Millennial cites how he has called out on the Democrats for the climate hypocrisy.
Not only do they not believe what they're saying, but their hypocrisy is rampant. Headed to this climate conference, these officials flew in giant jets. John Kerry has a private jet that has flown dozens of times this past year all around the country. I don't know about you, but I don't have a private jet. I don't believe any of the people on this stage have their own private jet.
Portland does.
John Kerry, when asked about his private jet, said, really, for someone like me, it's the only way that makes sense to travel. What dripping, condescending arrogance.
Joining us here in this segment is Robert Evans. He's a former member of the European Parliament. He is a British Labour cooperative politician who served as a member of the European Parliament from 1994 until 2009. He was first elected to the European Parliament for London North West, and then in 1999 and 2004 for the London constituency. Okay, Robert, welcome. Taking a look at what the U.S. Senator Ted Cruz has said about U.S. hypocrisy, slamming his fellow senator like John Kerry and other world leaders as a whole, on traveling on jets to this COP26 Glasgow summit. Does he have a point there?
Yeah, I think it's sending entirely the wrong message. I realize the challenges that some global leaders have getting from A to B or getting from their own country to Glasgow, but I think it's sending entirely the wrong message when they arrive in private airplanes and use private jets to go around. Most of these airlines have flights that could have come to London where they could have got a train or a number of people could have managed it. Using private airplanes, which are private jet, very, very carbon expensive, is entirely, not so much unnecessary, but it's sending completely the wrong message to everybody else. We had the situation where our Prime Minister Boris Johnson came back to London by private jet. Well, I looked it up. There were six possible scheduled airline flights that he could have taken, or a train from Glasgow to London. And we cannot have one rule for them and one rule for everybody else. So I think global leaders needed to reflect on that. Whatever the challenges, there's plenty of airlines that could have accommodated them.
Well, what Robert says there makes sense. It sounds fair enough. But herein actually lies the hypocrisy of what the U.S. Senator Ted Cruz has said. He received actually more money from oil and gas companies in 2018 than any other senator. Ted Cruz received nearly $800,000 from the oil and gas industry in the year 2018. And actually, when it comes to U.S. senators, four U.S. senators, one in four, that is, U.S. senators, still hold fossil fuel investments. The households of at least 28 senators own a combined minimum of $3.7 million and as much as $12.6 million in fossil fuel assets. Now, let's take a look at this tweet. It says the vicious spiral of global debt leaves countries at the front line of the climate crisis, unable to respond to its fallout. And the failure of the world's richest countries to lift the burden exposes their climate hypocrisy, as stated by the Tribune. When it comes to the COP26, it has actually exposed rich countries' debt hypocrisy. And that is where the problem is. Last year, $372 billion flowed out of lower-income countries in debt repayments. These are vital resources that could have been directed to tackling the climate emergency and the pandemic. Instead, lower-income countries are now paying five times more in debt than they are spending on fighting the climate crisis. Luca Lacorboni is a campaign manager for energy and climate, Greenpeace Italy, who joins us here to give his take on this. Luca, thanks for joining us here. When you take a look at the developing countries, there was a lack of representation. Why was that at this COP26 summit?
Most affected countries, so the countries that actually see climate change impacting their daily life almost every day around the world, are those countries that are less represented in the COP also in Glasgow. And this is absolutely unacceptable because the richest countries are those who are less feeling the impact of climate change and should hear the voices of the most affected countries and of the most affected people. This is another important sign of the fact that at the moment, also the COP26 in Glasgow is doing a lot of work, but really not enough actions.
All right, thank you very much for that. Luca telling us his reason for why they were underrepresented at the COP26. Now, do you know how much money was spent actually to fight the COVID-19 pandemic? How much money was spent saving businesses and governments and countries from actually crashing? Well, the Prime Minister of Barbados at the COP26 summit shed light on that and how there could have been a solution already in reducing global warming to the desired 1.5 degrees Celsius goal.
The central banks of the wealthiest countries engaged in $25 trillion of quantitative easing in the last 13 years. 25 trillion. Of that, 9 trillion was in the last 18 months to fight the pandemic. Had we used that 25 trillion to purchase bonds, to finance the energy transition, or the transition of how we eat, or how we move ourselves in transport, we would now today be reaching that 1.5 degrees limit that is so vital to us.
Our final social media post is about a social media giant that has changed its name to Meta, namely Facebook. A campaign advisor placed a large melting iceberg sculpture next to the Capitol building in Washington. This group said that Facebook had played a major role in not stopping the spread of climate disinformation.
Actually, climate disinformation is rampant on Facebook. There's 1.3 million views of climate disinformation daily. Facebook says that they send 100,000 people to their climate information center every day. But if we look at their numbers versus the numbers that we're getting from the researchers, there's a massive discrepancy of how much climate disinformation there really is on their platform.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for our in-depth section. When it comes to climate change, there needs to be strong will on all fronts, from political incentives to budgetary allocations. But with so much ground to cover on the issue, where is there a good place to actually start? Well, let's take a look at the companies that are responsible for most of the greenhouse gas emissions. You agree? That's a good place to start, I think. Taking a look at this, 20 fossil fuel companies, the major ones, they are responsible for 35%. That's a third of the greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, so we know that 20 companies are involved, so let's tackle them. I mean, if we know who these 20 companies are, then we should stop them from doing what they're doing. Well, if it was only that simple. What is needed is strong political will, then action to rein in the oil, gas, and coal companies responsible for them. Okay, let's find out who these companies are. Looking at the companies, well, there's a few of them, but let's look at the top ones. For example, Saudi Aramco, Gazprom, ExxonMobil, BP, Royal Dutch Shell, and then you have some of the other ones that are in the top. Look at how much CO2 they have actually emitted into the climate and into the atmosphere. You're looking at 480 billion tons of carbon dioxide. That's a lot of CO2. Never mind the environmental disasters that have happened over the decades. Okay, this is now where the controversy lies. The whole notion of the use of coal, oil, and gas and its detrimental effects on the climate and the environment, it was known a long time ago, as far back as the year 1965. Okay, let's go back to the year 1965. The U.S. President's Scientific Advisory Committee, it warned pollutants have altered on a global scale the carbon dioxide content of the air and the lead concentrations in ocean waters and human populations. In simpler language, fossil fuels were causing more carbon dioxide, which was altering the air on a global scale with huge risks for mankind. All right, let's move on to example number two. The head of the American Petroleum Institute issued a warning. The substance of the report was that there is still time to save the world's peoples from the catastrophic consequences of pollution, but that time was running out. So you're having warning after warning. Now, as if that wasn't enough, we're going to go now to the year 1981. This is an internal memo from ExxonMobil revealing a shocking warning. One of its managers sent an internal memo saying that the company's long-term business plans produce effects which will indeed be catastrophic, at least for a substantial fraction of the Earth's population. Well, the big old companies, however, were not going to pass on their profits. Taking a look at the year 1989, you're looking at a company by the name of Global Climate Coalition. It's a coalition, actually, that was formed. Not an environmental group, like the name may suggest. It worked, actually, to sow doubt about climate change. How did it do it? It lobbied lawmakers to block clean energy legislation and climate treaties throughout the 1990s. So imagine that, to sow doubt, and that's where people doubted the effects of climate change. All right, let's get an analysis on this. Rejoining us here in this segment is Robert Evans. Robert, welcome back. The COP26 goals was to reduce net zero carbon emissions. Okay, and Paris Agreement actually did that along with other summits. However, when you take a look at the commitments, I can mention what India has said, net zero emissions by the year 2070. Or how about Saudi Arabia making a commitment for net zero emissions by the year 2060, however, with no exit plan? I mean, that sounds so far into the future, and we were under the impression that there's not that much time. Don't you think those commitments are a little bit too far?
Yeah, they... Saudi Arabia is a very rich country that's done very, very well out of oil over many years. And, of course, I understand why it's worried about changing it. But if you're going to have a net zero by 2060, you know, that's nearly 40 years away. It's totally unacceptable as a target. Now, it may be that they don't reach it till then, but I do believe that countries have got to set ambitious targets and really make much greater moves. You know, the reason that we are still driving around in petrol-driven cars to the large extent, when 50 years ago they had the technology to build battery vehicles, but they just haven't developed it, is because of the power of the oil industry over the years. The oil industry in the Middle East and the plentiful supply of cheap oil and America, you know, if the amount of investment had gone into alternative forms that went into, for instance, mobile phones, which are now very sophisticated pieces of technology, if the same amount of effort and energy had gone into a more environmentally friendly mass-produced vehicles, we wouldn't all be driving around in petrol-driven vehicles at the moment.
So what are these subsidies? Who gives them out? First, here's John Kerry, the U.S. climate envoy, raising his concerns on climate change.
The statement lays out important steps on CO2 emissions as well, including the need to accelerate using best efforts by all of us to phase down unabated coal in this decade as fast as is achievable.
If he is the U.S. climate representative, he neglects to point out the following fact, that the U.S. government actually subsidized coal, oil, and gas for decades.
So in the draft today, we saw that coal was referenced in the draft, as well as subsidies. That's not good enough. 86% of the emissions trapped in our atmosphere come from oil, gas, and coal. And while we talk about targets and emissions here, these governments, many of them, especially the wealthy nations, are proposing new projects that would take us past 1.5 degrees.
And that is the hypocrisy of it all, which is no surprise that there are protests against this, as seen here.
At the moment, it's insufficient, and we need, you know, world leaders from the richest and most polluting countries to raise their ambition and to provide a, you know, clear mandate for countries to come back to the table next year with more ambitious emission reduction by 2030.
3, 2, 1, go.
One of the things that has stood out in this COP26 summit was the presence and action of the activists urging world leaders to act on climate change. They were keen on pointing out the hypocrisy of feeding lies to the general public. Take this group of activists, led by members of the Extinction Rebellion Direct Action Group. They highlighted how the mode of transportation chosen makes a difference, like opting to travel by train rather than air transportation. Another transportation mode that needs reforming is global shipping. There is actually a $1 trillion push to decarbonize it. Freight ships are huge carbon emitters. Therefore, if countries and companies hope to meet Paris Agreement targets, they must change the way freight shipping is managed. The use of electric batteries or alternative fuels is one way to go about this. At present, shipping products across the ocean using freight ships creates more greenhouse gas emissions than the estimated 2 billion U.S. cars and trucks on America's roads, at around 1 billion metric tons. Activists with the group Ocean Rebellion held a theatrical demonstration in COP26 to say that countries need to step up efforts to protect their national waters. They called for greater investment in ocean-based renewable energy, decarbonization of industries, and further research.
So today we have one of our Ocean Rebellion classic theatrical performances, creating conscious pricking imagery to try and help tell the story, which today is on the eve of COP Ocean Day, to draw attention to the delegates that our oceans need to be way up on their agenda. Right, it covers 70% of our ocean and provides 50 to 80% of the oxygen that we breathe. So it's vitally important, and our oceans are at crisis point.
12 years ago, at a United Nations climate summit in Copenhagen, rich nations made a significant pledge. They promised to channel $100 billion a year to less wealthy nations by 2020 to help them adapt to climate change and mitigate further rises in temperature. And in another clear case of climate hypocrisy, a climate activist walked toward the British finance minister and asked him about tax breaks and funding for fossil fuel companies. The UK Prime Minister made a pledge with some young pupils at his school to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Here is the first United States Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, John Kerry, with his grand emissions.
The IPCC report and the synthesis report of the NDCs indicate that we have to achieve somewhere in the vicinity of a 45% reduction over the next 10 years.
But the best these two leaders could do was to squeeze this out of Saudi Arabia, a 2060 pledge. That does it for me. Your questions and comments are truly appreciated if you get the time. Just drop us a line.
The COP26 climate summit has ended. More than 190 nations reached a deal, but without an enforcement mechanism. Well, critics are saying the agreement, which calls on governments to strengthen greenhouse gas emission cuts, is going to fall short. So there you go. Another summit which fell short. Well, we've told you about climate pledge hypocrisies, but honestly, here's where the problem lies. We are a consumer-driven society. We use billions of products which have the material produced from these oil companies. Unless we change the way we live and spend our money, things are not going to change. These companies know that, and that is why they will not live up to their commitments to clean energy to the fullest. I mean, really, is that even possible? Something to think about. That does for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. We do appreciate any questions or comments that you can send to us. We always look forward to them. From Mikko Vitale, the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim. Bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Previously, we were looking at human rights from the eyes and perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salamullah. And we shall continue looking at this topic through his perspective. Among the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he gave high priority to is the right of family and the right of marriage and the right of childhood. Now we do understand that among the most simple, basic fundamentals of rights is on the person is the right to create a family. For Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he considers it to be the basic, the foundation of any society, of any civilization. So Islam came and he put the foundation and laid the rules to creating a strong family and gave it its rights and gave it protection, because through the successful family we have a successful society, through a successful society we have a successful country, and we have a successful world. So the entire universe, or at least let's say the entire earth itself, consists of people who live amongst each other, be it in nations, be it in tribes, be it in small communities. And the basic and the first brick that we have to lay is the family itself. So it consists of that family. So the Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam and Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, first and foremost, they put a great emphasis on the relationship between two partners. And they consider this the link between the strength of the community, the strength of the society, the strength of the ummah, and the relationship itself. So if this relationship continues, then so would society. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he considers getting married, creating a family, having children, is a natural right of every human being. And he was dealing with this issue from a realistic perspective by identifying the problems and by identifying where things could go wrong and what is necessary for the continuation of humanity itself, beginning with trying to touch on the human sexual desire itself, because sometimes it is the cause of corruption and sometimes it is the destruction of society, destruction of families, destruction of relationship itself between two partners. If this not being dealt with in a proper manner, this sexual relationship of a person or his desire to have his sexual needs met, if they are not dealt with in a correct manner, it would turn the human being into an animalistic person, or at least he will be an animal in the real sense of the word, that will create and cause corruption on earth. Unless that is met and that is being dealt with, things will go wrong. So we can see even through the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when he talks to people when it comes to the matter of their sexual desire, he says it needs to be controlled, it needs to be maintained, it needs to be at least put in a way where it's only used in the correct manner. Now, there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi where he talks to specifically men in this regard, because sometimes we are blaming women for everything, but Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi says it's an equal responsibility when it comes to men and women, when it comes to controlling their desires and not letting it run wild that causes corruption and problems in community, or at least in the family to begin with. Let us take a short break and then inshallah we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were saying Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam was talking to men about controlling their sexual desires in order to have a safer family, safer relationship, and a safer community in return. So he says, إِيَّاكَ وَكَثْرَةِ الْوَلَهِ بِالنِّسَاءِ. I warn you and not to dive too deep in your desires in women. وَالْإِغْرَاءَ بِاللَّذَّاتِ. And do not indulge yourself too much in desires. فَإِنَّ الْوَلَهَ بِالنِّسَاءِ وَالْمُغْرَى بِاللَّذَّاتِ مُمْتَهَنْ. For he who indulges too much in women and too much in desires, he will be humiliated. So such a person who lives on this line where he only wants to meet his desires, he is not a valued member of society. He's not going to contribute to society because all that he cares about, it's himself. If he's satisfied, if he has what he needs, then he's okay. If he's not, then he will go around creating problems for the community and for the society and for the entire nation together. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he comes and looks at marriage as a constitution, he looks at it as a holy constitution that needs to be respected, and he lays the foundation to this constitution itself. Now, what we need to understand is that the societies that we live in and the oppressors and the tyrants of each society, the causes of their tyranny, the causes of their oppression usually stems from personal moral, corrupted moral vices. When these people themselves are corrupted when it comes to their desires and their vices, obviously they will take that onto people. Even Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he looks at, for example, the social level or political level, he says it gets destroyed because people become, as he uses the word, the urban wasalatina. They become nothing but wolves and tyrants. And then he talks about how they eat the wealth and the money of those who are poor, and they take it by power. And they use, whether it is lying, whether it is, you know, fighting with people, and they just use all these kind of methods to take the rights of other people. So he says from here, unless a person, first and foremost, gets to control himself and maintains his morals and values, then he is a threat to society itself. From here, he comes and lays the foundation that these people, because they have that desire, because they're human beings, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has embedded such a thing into them, it's a thing that they cannot deny, a thing they cannot get rid of. Rather, they have to deal with it in the correct manner. From here, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa ala and Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam and all other imams and even the Quran, they laid the foundation to starting a prosperous, happy relationship and a happy family. And that is the right of every human being. This is not limited to the elite. This is not limited to a specific level of community or a level of the society. This should be the right of everybody. If that's maintained, if that's covered, then we should have a prosperous, happier society. Inshallah, we'll continue this topic in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.